It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
One, drag your kids to pride. When did tolerance turn into encouragement? Two, it's been debated whether or not the NBA would one day replace the NFL. It might be a better debate. Would one day the NHL replace the NBA? Three, what arrows do we have in our quiver to solve the economy? Might there be an arrow that once conservatives would oppose that now today stands as a solution? It's the Will Cain Podcast on Fox News Podcast. What's up? And welcome to a new week. Welcome to Monday. As always, I hope you will download, rate, and review wherever you get your audio entertainment, Apple, Spotify, or at Fox News Podcasts. Take what you say seriously, but don't take yourself seriously. I was thinking about that earlier today when I was flying back from New York City to Dallas. And now that the age of COVID is over and you're no longer having to cover half of your face, I'm encountering more of you out there. I'm meeting more of you in the airports. And one of the questions I always get is it real? Do you and Pete and Rachel really like each other on Fox and Friends weekend? If you'll give me just a moment of a lack of humility, if you'll give me just a moment to do the unseemly thing of bragging, Fox and Friends weekend, I think one of the best shows on television. I don't think it's just my opinion. I've heard that from many of you. I've heard that from many a critic, and I'm hearing that more and more at the highest levels of media. And most people acknowledge one of the reasons that Fox and Friends weekend has distinguished itself even within the universe of Fox News. And the answer is chemistry. Is it real? Do you, Rachel and Pete, really like each other? And the answer is yes. But liking someone is interesting. It's not enough to establish the mystical ingredient of chemistry. I've been a part of many television shows throughout my career. I once hosted Starting Point with Soledad O'Brien on CNN. I was once part of In the Arena with Elliot Spitzer on CNN. I was on First Take with Stephen A. Smith and Max Kellerman. I hung out for a good chunk of time with Ryan Russillo on The Russillo Show on ESPN Radio. And of course, I was, in my estimation, part of an ensemble when I hosted the solo show of The Will Cain Show on ESPN Radio. I hung out with my guys, Cerruti, Nuno, Bubba, Mike A., and Pat, on a daily basis. And chemistry is about something more than just liking each other. Chemistry is what makes good television. Outside of a solo show, and I would even venture to you, when you see a successful television show behind the scenes, someone has tapped into that mystical art of chemistry. Tucker Carlson is without a doubt the preeminent solo host in American media. I can tell you from experience and just from logical deduction, there's a lot of chemistry going on behind the scenes with that staff, with the producers at every level. To generate that number of ideas takes, yes, an absolutely, perhaps, once-in-a-generation type talent, but it also takes a team. And simply liking each other isn't enough. This weekend, as Hegseth and Lawrence Jones literally ricocheted me in one of those blow-up knocker balls, and at the age of 47, I did wonder, is my back going to recover? You have to think there's more than simply liking these dudes at the end of the day. Now, you've got to have some level of mutual respect. You've got to care what someone else has to say You also really honestly have to have some level of humility, which is an odd thing to say in an industry that's built upon overinflated egos. You got to be able to give up time. You've never met someone on television who hasn't felt like they didn't get enough time to talk. And you have to have some level of humility to realize you're part of a team and part of a show that is about something more than your opinion. Inside the NBA on TNT is the best television production, most certainly when it comes to an ensemble cast. Really, honestly, probably within the past decade. You could point to a few other examples, The Five on the Fox News channel. In its heyday, which we are long past its heyday, perhaps The View on ABC. But you have to be generous of spirit. You have to always be feeling like you got shortchanged in the greater good. And this is where sports comes into play for me, because this is really what sports is about, almost always as well. You know, again, setting aside truly beyond once in a generation level talents like Michael Jordan, who are good enough to truly take over as an individual, most of sports is submitting your ego to humility and submitting it to less than you think is its optimal state in order for the team to succeed. I mean, this was the big challenge with Kobe and Shaq. How much of each could give up of their individualism to accomplish more as a team? This is honestly the story of life. Again, I think you're going to find outliers who just through their sheer will of individualism are capable of accomplishing great things. And make no mistake, individual greatness is part of the ingredient. You can't put 3, 4, 5 mediocre human beings together and hope for greatness. But if you hope to add up more to the sum of your parts, you have to have individuals who are willing to submit the ego to the whole. And in addition to liking each other, in addition to some level of humility, in addition to mutual respect, you've got to be able to take what you say seriously, but not take yourself seriously. And that in the end, I think, is why I begin this conversation. Is it real? Yes. Just like it's real for you in your life, and just like it's real for me in my private life. All the things I just described apply to us when we go to a barbecue, when we go to work, with our wives or husbands at home. When to give, when to take, how to be more than simply the individual. This is the story of all of us as part of a community. And I think one of the most undersold aspects of chemistry, not just in television, because as egotistical as I am, this in the end, as you know, isn't ultimately about television. It's even more egotistical. I think I have a great life lesson for us all through the prism of Fox and Friends Weekend. But that life lesson is, take what you say seriously, but don't take yourself seriously. Laugh at yourself, like Charles Barkley. Make fun of your own feet, like Shaquille O'Neal. Go knock the snot, not just out of one of your friends, but allow yourself to have the snot knocked out of you on national television, like Pete Hegseth. Stuff your face full of food, and then turn around and give an honest and authentic opinion about who you are and the way you see the world. Take what you say seriously. Don't take yourself seriously. Story number one. When did tolerance turn into encouragement? When did the oppressed turn into the oppressor? It is Pride Month, which means it is drag your kids to Pride Month. Couple of Sodom and Gomorrah-esque stories from this week in the United States of America. Pizza Hut, the pizza chain, as part of its yearly Book It program, which is designed to get young kids to read, encouraged Pizza Hut customers to pick up the book Big Wig, which is designed for pre-kindergartners through third grade. The story of Big Wig is about a magical wig that kids can wear as a costume and share. And as that wig is worn, it transforms regular, everyday, shy, insecure children into confident drag queens. Big Wig is an embracement of the drag queen. Now, this story comes to you at the same time that in Dallas, Texas, my hometown, for Pride Month, an event was hosted that was entitled Drag Your Kids to Pride. Now, this event featured parents bringing their children to a pop-up strip show. Strip show in the effect of a runway, dollar bills, and drag queens bumping and grinding down the runway. When did tolerance become acceptance? When did we become Sodom and Gomorrah? Now listen, I want to talk context for just a moment. I am no prude. In fact, I think if we were all taking dope loads of sodium pentothal, if we were on truth serum, the truth is for most of my life, I have been perhaps a libertine. If there's something to enjoy, I generally was one of the guys ready to enjoy. I am not someone who has enjoyed moralizing to others, looking down my nose, holier than thou. I've never thumped the Bible. I'm working on reading the Bible. I've always been someone trying to work on myself, not work on you. I don't think I have ever been someone, yes, to sermonize to my children over the dinner table, usually through the prism of sports, and to sermonize at times with you in all self-awareness, but never one to tell you how to live your life. But there's a difference between live and let live and honestly pushing sexualization onto children. More context. This comes, of course, as June is Pride Month in the United States of America. And street corners in New York City, bars in New York City, corporate logos on Twitter, and perhaps in every town, including your town, across this great land, rainbow flags, and increasingly the innumerable number of stripe flags have taken over every flagpole in the U.S. of A. This, of course, is the height of hypocrisy. Bobby Burak, writing at OutKick, did a great job of laying this out. I think the best example of this when it comes to corporate America is Pfizer. Pfizer, of course, is America's, what, leading policymaker for the past 2 or 3 years? Pfizer. Does it get more powerful? Pfizer has transformed all of its social media pages to, of course, the rainbow pride image in its Twitter logo. Pfizer's not alone. Again, every corporation has done so. In fact, every corporation has done so to the extent that it gathered the attention of Elon Musk. Elon Musk tweeted out a meme of a tornado of corporate logos in rainbow fashion flying through America. But here's what's fascinating. Pfizer, according to Burak, as he did this research and laid it out on OutKick, changed its logo to the rainbow flag in USA, in most of Europe. But it didn't change its rainbow flag universally across the world. Take, for example, Saudi Arabia, where same-sex sexual activity is illegal. Pfizer did not change its logo to the rainbow flag on Pfizer Saudi. Interesting. Isn't that fascinating? This is, of course, in the same vein of the Walt Disney Company or its subsidiary ESPN, preaching to the American people about the evils of the quote-unquote don't say gay bill, which, of course, is a propaganda-driven misnomer of the bill that suggests you cannot preach sexualization to children under third grade. ESPN and Walt Disney, happy to moralize to Americans on a law in Florida, but silent when it comes to its laws or its business in China, or doing business with, for example, the NBA in the UAE. You can find this hypocrisy all across the corporate landscape. And you know why in the greater context? Because this has nothing to do with principle. This has nothing to do with tolerance. This has only something to do with the cheapest possible virtue one can accomplish in modern American society. And of course, it's not simply corporations. It's us. It's individuals as well. Changing your Twitter avatar to a rainbow flag means nothing, especially when we see you do business in a place where they employ slave labor. Oh, say, like China. No, it's simply a way to say, perhaps, from the corporate executives, please don't hurt me. I'm afraid. I'm going along to get along. But more likely, I'm good. I am virtuous. Just like the corporation, so goes the individual. The vast majority of people on social media, well, I think generally good or well-meaning, are asking of us one of two things. Please don't hurt me. My pronouns are in my bio. Or probably more likely, I am holier than thou. If you're looking for the modern day thumper of some item, it's not a Bible they're thumping. It's a social media account they're thumping. If you're looking for the modern day equivalent of looking down your nose at someone, it's not the person on the first pew of their church house. It's the person monitoring everyone else's social media account. This isn't sincerity. This isn't actual authenticity. This isn't real. This is the opposite of how we began our conversation. This is not taking what you say seriously. This is taking yourself seriously. It's not authentic. It's fake. It's cheap. It's unearned virtue, both as individuals and as a corporation. That is the greater context wherein we see both the story of Pizza Hut and the Drag Your Child to Pride event in Dallas, Texas. Now, earlier this week, I got a chance to view a new documentary by The Daily Wire's Matt Walsh. Matt Walsh will be appearing on the Will Cain podcast in the near future. The documentary is entitled What is a Woman? And it is a entertainment, somewhat comedic, somewhat serious, certainly a spotlight on the issue of transgenderism, wherein Matt Walsh travels the world and asks a very simple question of psychiatrists, of physicians, of African tribes. What is a woman? Now, here's what's fascinating in this documentary. You hear from doctors who perform surgeries on patients as young as 16, where they remove a penis or destroy a vagina. These aren't my words, because what you will also hear in this documentary are the words of a trans man who is saying to you, as someone who has transitioned from a female to a male, what we're doing to children is nothing. And I mean this, no hyperbole. In fact, it's impossible to make this exaggerated, that what we're doing to children is child abuse. We're walking around acting like we can mutilate children with no repercussions, because a 13-year-old, 14-year-old, 8-year-old says to you, this is the phase that I'm in. The same group of people who tell you they will be a professional athlete, and a few of them will, but 99.9% of them will not. The same group of people who tell you their major career choice is professional athlete can tell you that they're going to change their gender, and we take that seriously and track down an amoral doctor. You hear from a doctor who is willing to prescribe puberty blockers, and now we're reducing the age from 16 to something like 8. Whenever you hit puberty, just pre-puberty, prescribing puberty blockers, okay, and talking not just casually, flippantly about you can pause puberty, and no big deal, NBD, when we go off the puberty blockers, you just go right back. You just play catch up. Of course, they don't know that, because there's been no long-term studies on the effects of puberty blockers. Many of these drugs, as pointed out by Walsh in this documentary, are the same drugs that we give to sex offenders, pedophiles, for chemical castration. In other words, what we use to chemically castrate pedophiles, we use for our children and act like it's just a pause button. Tell me this is not the characteristics of Sodom and Gomorrah. That doesn't take a holier-than-thou religiosity to wonder, What have we become? This is so sinful, so amoral, that all of our modern predilections we focus on are children. Let's talk to them about neo-racism and make them see the world through the prism of race. Let's encourage them to mess with their bodies. Totally ignorant and totally carelessly to the long-term implications. Let's let sports for them be ruined by letting boys pretend to be girls. And let's sexualize them by encouraging them to dress up in drag. Now let's return to that. If drag were simply dressing up in a costume, if drag were simply an exercise in tolerance, that would be a different discussion. Drag for an adult can be anything you want it to be. I have had gay friends who I love to this day all throughout my life. And I do have even gay friends who love drag. I would love to have them in this conversation because the question isn't about them as adults. The question is it appropriate for children? Because here's the truth about drag. You don't dress up as Laura Ingalls from Little House on the Prairie. You don't dress up like a 44-year-old school mom, a soccer mom. You dress up like a stripper. That is drag. It is inherently sexualized. Have you ever noticed when people dress up in drag, they don't wear ankle-length dresses? They don't wear hose? No, they wear the same thing that strippers wear. And I got nothing against strippers. Again, back to the top of this conversation. If we're being honest about our lives, I've enjoyed strippers in the past. Sweetheart, in the past. However, this is targeted to 8-year-olds. Who out there, which of you out there think, you know what would be a good idea? Sweetheart, what do you want to do tonight? I don't know. Let's load up Timmy and take him to Baby Dolls. Well, that would be fun. Yeah, nice family night at the strip club. I hear they have good steak and shrimp. Yeah, the surf and turf. Nice. Grab the dollar bills, baby. Give Timmy about 100 ones. No one does that. So why do you do it if it's in drag? How is that acceptable? Of course it's not. Drag is not about simply wearing a costume. It's about sexualization. So why are we sexualizing kids and acting as though that's okay? Here's why. And listen to me now and stay with me. Because of social justice. Oh, Will, here you go. Fox News talking point. What's this have to do with critical race theory? What's this have to do with the NBA's favorite mantra? Listen, social justice is about, philosophically, and believe it or not, although the casual observer, may not see it at the depth, may just be a simple empathetic feeling, it has roots, and there are people driving this from a philosophical perspective. Critical race theory is not alone. It has cousins in, for example, critical queer theory, critical gender theory. All of them branches on the tree off of critical theory. And critical theory is the way to see the world through the lens now of oppressor and oppressed. Your station in life, the way society is designed, the systems and framework can all be explained through the prism of oppressor and oppressed. Now, according to critical theory, any type of marginalized or minority community is in the seat of the oppressed. And the goal of critical theory is not to achieve equality. It's quite explicit about this. Not to achieve tolerance and acceptance and equality, but to achieve equity. And equity requires unequal outcomes. Therefore, equity requires a reverse of the roles of oppressor and oppressed. The oppressed must become the oppressor to achieve equity. Why is this important? Because it explains how we got here, how we moved beyond tolerance and acceptance to encouragement. You see, Barack Obama was opposed to gay marriage. Bill Clinton was opposed to gay marriage. The movement, which I was a part of, to accept gay marriage, someone who said we as a government should acknowledge the ability of people to be recognized in a loving relationship by the government of the United States, regardless of their sexuality, quickly blew past tolerance and started moving towards not just encouragement, but repression. You have to repress the previous oppressor. What does that mean? It means villainize. It means villainize traditional marriage, villainize the traditional family, villainize the church, villainize anything that previously was seen as the oppressor. And therefore, you're totally justified to encourage breaking down traditional roles, breaking down husband and wife, breaking down the taboos, even of sexualizing children. Look, you can't deny this when these are in their own words. These explanations I'm giving you of critical theory and then the branches of critical gender theory, critical queer theory, critical race theory, it's all there. It's all explained. I want you to listen in their own words to the Dallas Drag Your Kids to Pride event. The journalists at Essential Fleckas, it's a podcast, Fleckas Talks the Podcast, they went to the Dallas event and they asked some of the drag queens there who were performing in front of a neon sign that said, "It's not going to lick itself," as they twerked and grinded the floor at this event with kids throwing ones. What do you hope to accomplish? I want you to listen to the answers.
So we just got done with the Drag Your Kid to Pride event at Mr. Mister in downtown Dallas, and I am here with
Noelle Sinclair.
What do you say to the conservative parents that wouldn't bring their children to an event like this?
Why? Here's the thing. I don't think that there is any kind of issue with exposing children to this.
So do you think exposing children to drag will result in more kids doing drag eventually?
I think so. And I hope so, because like I said, it's the biggest confidence booster. Like, yes, it can be negative at times, but I think that drag builds confidence.
Do you think exposing kids to drag will make more children go into drag eventually?
I feel like yes, because I feel drag is such like an art form. There's so much dancing, there's hair, there's wigs, there's makeup. There's so many things that kids will love to experience with. So I feel like a lot of kids will want to like dabble in everything that's going on in like drag.
There you go. To encourage more kids to perform in drag. And listen, again, it's not saying bend gender rules. It's not saying encourage kids to wear mom jeans. It's saying encourage kids to dress up as strippers and dance sexually and toss ones. It's the sexualization of children. We have to ask ourselves, where's our line? How much is too much? What are we willing to go along with? The parents that you can see in these videos, they have to answer to the same hypocrisy that corporations and individuals out there as to what is their true motivation. Is this really about tolerance and acceptance? Is this really about raising your kid to be a better person? Or is this about showing the world that you're a better person by the modern definition? Are you not using your children just like your Twitter avatar? Are they not your human version of a rainbow flag? You think all those kids wanted to be at that event? I saw some videos of some young boys sitting there playing their video games at the bar, by the way. No, this is exploiting children for your own cheap, unearned virtue. And therefore, we have to ask what's next. What else will you sell out for your cheap path to virtue? What's the next step? 10 years ago, Barack Obama was opposed to gay marriage. 10 years later, it's drag your kids to pride. What's next? You think the right-wing crazies are crazy to bring up grooming? If this isn't grooming, what is? So what's next? What step will you take? What are you willing to go along with? What is too much? Because I think for many of us, we've already crossed that line. We're already Sodom and Gomorrah.
We're going to step aside here for a moment. Stay tuned.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. January 26th, 1988 was a cold and suspiciously quiet night at the Indianapolis Police Department, but the frigid night took a chilling turn with news of a triple homicide. This week, I'm joined by retired Sergeant Judd Green for a look back at this savage case. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and FoxNewsPodcast.com.
Story number two. The NBA's ratings keep going down. Once we debated, would the NBA replace the NFL? Maybe we should debating, will the NHL replace the NBA? The ratings for the first game of the NBA Finals between the Boston Celtics and the Golden State Warriors are out. 11.9 million people tuned in for game one. It's hard to fully put this into context, but let us put it in comparison to simply 5 years ago. 5 years ago, when the Golden State Warriors took on the Cleveland Cavaliers, 20 million people watched the NBA Finals on average per game. If you actually rewind the clock, 25 years ago, it is admittedly to the height of the Michael Jordan era or the tail end of the Michael Jordan era, 30 million people on average watched each game of the NBA Finals. Again, this year, we're down to 11.9 million people. Now, that's up. That's up from the pandemic year when they didn't play on the regular schedule, when it dropped to 8 to 9 million people, and that's good. But this is markedly lower than the NBA was accomplishing as recently as 5 years ago. Here's a fascinating debate I was having 5 years ago, and this debate was being had in all seriousness. Will the NBA replace the NFL? That was a legitimate question on First Take. And there were legitimate commentators taking the affirmative. Yes, the NBA will replace the NFL. Could any take have aged more poorly? It didn't even have to age. It was poor when it was spit out of the oven. This was dumb from jump. Listen, the NFL, to put it into context, averages per game 17 million viewers. This year, that's up 10% over last year. So your random NFL game on a Sunday, 1 o'clock window, 17 million viewers, maybe slightly less as a higher window game gets more viewers. But your average, 17 million viewers. Again, the NBA Finals, almost 12. Almost 12. Don't even bring up the Super Bowl. I mean, come on. The Super Bowl last year, 112 million viewers. Yeah, the NBA, it's going to replace the NFL. What you have, honestly, is the impossibility of having an honest conversation about the NBA. And listen, this is coming from an NBA fan. I know that it's become a punching bag in the culture wars. It's seen as something that the right wing, the quote unquote right wing, likes to hit. And in response to that, all of sports media defends the NBA on everything. It's not even a media. Honestly, it's just a propaganda advocacy arm for this sports league, and simply just this one sports league. From like 2015, 16, 17, what you saw was the NFL take on the black hat of the villain. Because of Colin Kaepernick, the NFL became persona non grata to the media. In the NBA, while Kevin Durant and Steph Curry and Steve Kerr declined to visit the White House, wouldn't deign to be in the company of President Trump, became the darling of sports media. But something fascinating happened along the way. You become the darling of Twitter, and you become the darling of sports media, and you become the ire of the American population. They went, did the NBA, from 20 million viewers in 2017 to about 17 million off the top of my head in 2018 to 9 million in 2019. Now, some complicating factors in there, including the 2019 finals were between the Toronto Raptors and the Golden State Warriors. Canadian ratings don't count on the side of America. So artificially depressed right there, but they stayed low. Then you had pandemic year issues, 2020 and 2021, and they've rebounded now to only about a little more than half of where they were in 2013, 14, 15, and 16. And you cannot sell me on the fact that politics did not play some role. Now, this started before the BLM movement. This started with the NBA becoming inherently political. It's funny, everybody was accusing the NFL of being political, and the political stance the NFL took was simply stand for America. That's it. Stand for America, which at one time was considered fairly apolitical. Meanwhile, in the NBA, don't visit the White House, speak out against Trump, Steve Kerr preaching about gun control, taking openly political policy positions. And then, of course, culminating in 2020 with Black Lives Matter, which the NBA thought, like standing up for America, wasn't a political position. Again, a take that aged like milk, more like aged right out of the oven. It was bad from the start. Anybody could see BLM was a political movement as it engaged in political false talking points about the number of unarmed Black men killed in America, as it lied about the individual facts of each incident, aka Jacob Blake being unarmed, and then of course culminating in BLM absconding with fraudulently stealing millions and millions of dollars from its own supporters. Since that time, BLM was a fraudulent and political organization from the beginning, and Mark Cuban will tell you today, fine, it's not an organization, it's simply a mantra. Black Lives Matter. It's no more a mantra than the raised fist is, or the picture of Che Guevara is. Okay, it's just a symbol from a rebellious kid who buys a t-shirt. No, it has some connection to some ugly history and some real world policy and politics. That is the culmination of the NBA's missteps. So, I mean, I think a better question actually is, I mean, it's a joke to compare it to the NFL. Is the NBA protected from the bottom side by other sports? The average NBA game gets 3 million viewers. You know what the average Major League Baseball game gets? 1.13 million viewers. Nobody ever talks about Major League Baseball, not in national media. In fact, the only pub that Major League Baseball gets is about how bad its ratings are. Always, always how bad. And you know what its ratings are for the World Series last year? 11.7 million. Again, game one of the NBA Finals, 11.9 million. One, propped up by an advocacy media as the replacement for the NFL. The other, seen as a dying dinosaur. And their ratings, the same. And both headed south. I asked, a better question might be, will the NBA be replaced by the NHL? NHL ratings, 460,000 per game on average, 2.5 million in the Stanley Cup. The NBA is closer to Major League Baseball and the NHL than it is to the NFL.
We'll be right back with more of the Will Cain Podcast.
Story number three. How many quivers do we have? Or how many arrows do we have in the quiver to solve the economy? The economy is headed in some very, very concerning directions, something we need to talk about more here and come to understand on the Will Cain Podcast. It's possible we are in a recession as we speak. We haven't got first quarter GDP numbers quite yet. A recession technically is two straight quarters of negative growth. Stagnant or negative growth when it comes to GDP. We have, of course, inflation, I believe now, well over 8%. And the main quiver that the federal government has to control inflation is raising interest rates. Our mortgage, any type of loan we're maintaining out there, begins to be affected as the Federal Reserve has said it will raise interest rates over the coming months. So we're looking at increased interest rates pushing us into a recession, or spiraling inflation pushing us into a recession. And perhaps, worst case scenario, both. Increased interest rates and rising inflation for stagflation. So we have to ask ourselves, not how we got here. We know, and we've had the discussion of how we got here. the Biden administration, and for that matter, the Trump administration before it, spent tons of money in pandemic relief. And the Federal Reserve printed tons of money, not just in pandemic relief, but in economic sustainability to sustain our national and individual debt. We have a lifestyle. We got to maintain it. If you look at the money supply, it's absolutely exploded. You can see a chart of our money supply over the last several decades, and it's, talk about a hockey stick, forget climate change. Our money supply is a hockey stick. But instead of looking at how we got here, I think we have to start asking, how do we get out? Obviously, electoral politics are going to be a part of that. But then this brings the two issues together. You know, for years, conservatives, and I would have defined myself 10, 12 years ago as a libertarian, would have been adamantly opposed to the idea of tariffs, taxes on imported goods from foreign countries, because we would have embraced the idea of free trade. A rising tide lifts all boats. Cheaper products, even if jobs go overseas, means we have a higher quality of life. And here at home, well, the workforce moves on to a more highly specialized, higher rung on the ladder of the economic ladder of employment. I don't really advocate for those types of policies or principles anymore, because I've seen the effect of cheap, meaningless goods at the cost of purposeful, meaningful jobs. So, where should we stand today on tariffs? The Trump administration put into place $300 billion in tariffs on China. And this covers all kinds of goods. Of course, steel and aluminum, but also some lower in the economy price point types of good, medical devices and others. $300 billion worth of tariffs. Now, the Biden administration has said it will possibly look at lifting some of those tariffs to try to ease the rising price of goods. There's some studies that suggest tariffs in and of themselves have cost us 1.3% when it comes to inflation. But this is where we have the debate. What's more valuable, cheaper goods or meaningful jobs? And do we have to make that Sophie's choice? Yeah, you know, I'm willing to admit and to consider the idea that tariffs actually lead to increased prices for America. Again, 10 to 12 years ago, I would have said absolutely. And I will acknowledge today that there's a trade-off. And if we have to pay more for an iPhone or we have to pay more for some product made in China, I acknowledge that's a potentiality for a tariff. But on the flip side, more factories come home. More workers come home. It's already worked, by the way, in steel. More steel jobs, more steel manufacturing has come back to America. We're running at a deficit of meaning and purpose. We're running at a deficit of productive males. We're running at a deficit of people showing up to jobs that give their sense of life meaning. So, is that worth the trade-off for a cheaper iPhone? Unfortunately, that's not the only part of the equation. There's also national security. As we ship off our pharmaceuticals to China, even some of our weapons manufacturing to China, is that not worth paying just a little bit more? I would be opposed at this point to lifting tariffs, most specifically and obviously from China, but I'd be willing to consider whatever tariffs out there can bring jobs home at the price of some higher prices in goods. But that doesn't mean we have to reconcile ourselves to 8% inflation. Because one thing that we can and should be making right here at home is energy. There is no reason for us to be begging Saudi Arabia for oil and gas, for talking to Venezuela, for talking to Iran. These are our enemies, talking to them about energy. Of course, because we want to repress our own energy production, we want to pursue a green energy climate economy. We don't need to. And this is also a matter of meaning and productivity and national security. You know, people talk about it's not just the price of your cheap phone, it's the inputs, the parts, our semiconductors that we import, that go into our cars. We're talking about inputs in the end products. that factor into all of our prices. But the main input in any economy is energy that runs the lights, that runs our vehicles, that runs the heating and cooling. The main number one input is energy. And making that at home cheaper and cleaner with more jobs for Americans should be the focus. That's how you maintain tariffs on goods being produced by your enemy. How you produce meaningful and purposeful jobs at home. And you bring down inflation by lowering the ultimate input in production, oil and gas. We'll look more into the economy going forward. It's something that affects us all. The stock market's down, I think, 12% this year. Inflation, again, is eating up everyone's paycheck. It's the ultimate regressive tax. Progressives pushing for a regressive tax, or implementing a regressive tax, meaning it hits the poorest among us in inflation. Gas prices now at, I believe, $4.81 a gallon in places. Some places like California, over six, up to $8 a gallon. The economy is the number one issue. Maybe we shouldn't be focusing on drag our kids to pride. We should be focusing on providing our kids purpose and meaning and productivity. That's going to do it for me today here on the Will Cain Podcast. I'll see you again later this week.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity Podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free-fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.